I'd like to talk about this week's obsession, if I may have the floor momentarily.
I feel at this point it would be rude to not let you, you know, this far into podquisition. It'd be a change of form.
Just be like, right, no, you don't get that beginning bit, that weird, unfunny monologue you do at
you
the beginning.
You can have the beginning bit, but it can't be about a thing you're interested in. Taken off the... No. This week will permit it. What are you obsessed with?
Right. The Ultimate Warrior. I'm looking at a gif of him right now. He looks wrong.
Well, he was, all hopped up on everything. That was a guy who loved a drug.
The biggest drug that he was on was the Ultimate Warrior.
What better drug could you be on? Would you rather be on?
What else would you expect? Like, I brought up some quotes from his promos that WWF aired on TV. This guy was beloved by kids, right? Mm-hmm. I didn't get to watch a lot of wrestling as a child. I loved the Ultimate Warrior. I had a figure. His arms moved back and sprung forward so he could throw the Big Boss Man, who was another toy we had. But I've just become obsessed with this guy that can't wrestle for shit and is just so confusing and yet became a huge star temporarily and would say things like, dig your claws into my organs, stretch into my tendons, bury your anchors into my bones, for the power of the warrior will always prevail. And kids would go, yes, that's good. I want you to talk about this.
We saw this phenomenon play out for us, in our professional lives, as we watched all of these gaming YouTubers that added nothing of substance to the conversation and just screamed with neon lights. They're all Ultimate
Warrior.
That's
true. No, I mean, you really make a point.
That's what kids are into.
Sometimes you just need to be so loud that kids assume that you know something. You must know what's going on. You're so much louder than anyone else.
You're just making noise. That's it. You're just making noise. That's all they're attracted to. It's like jangling keys.
And that was his whole thing. He would be out of breath before he got to the ring. Not even I get that.
Now, are you hopped up on all that coke, though?
Well, he would run to the ring at cheetah speed and then grab the top rope and shake it up and down like lots and lots and lots, and then the match would start and he'd be too exhausted to do his three wrestling moves that he can do, one of which is a punch. His finishing move was a splash. His finishing move was, I will just fall on top of you because I can't do anything. The stories about him are amazing. Bobby the Brain Heenan, a very famous wrestling manager, one of the all-time greats, hated him because he had a really bad neck injury, and the Ultimate Warrior once just lifted him above his head in a gorilla press and just dropped him. And was once asked, what does he think of the Ultimate Warrior during an interview? And he told the interviewer, come here, follow me. They got up, they walked to the bathroom, he flushed the toilet and said, that's what I think of the Ultimate Warrior. And then the Ultimate Warrior said really gross things about Bobby's terminal illness, fantasizing about him changing his own shit bags. He was a horrible man, by the way, the Ultimate Warrior. A fascinating creature, but a terrible man who once said that queering doesn't make the world work. But his wife, Dana Warrior, said that before he died, he was sorry for that. Now, he never said it himself, but he was sorry for that. The stories about him are incredible. All of them feature him being, unsafe and rude and the worst. Another great quote, now you must deal with the creation of all the unpleasantries in the entire universe as I feel the injection from the gods above. Now, it wasn't gods you were getting an injection from, mate.
That's steroids, right?
That was a certain doctor that testified at a certain trial. Should I jump off the tallest building in the world? Should I lay on the lawn and let it run over me with lawnmowers? Should I go to Africa and let it trample me with raging elephants? That's something he asked Hulk Hogan, because that's what he would always say. He'd go, oh, Hulk Hogan, like that. He once told him to perform a terrorist attack. There's this amazing promo on YouTube where he's just like, go into the plane's cockpit. The pilots have already made their sacrifice. Grab that. Right?
Grab that
lever
about?
And turn it into a nosedive. It's so fucking amazing. He once screamed at an interviewer for being too normal. You are normal. You don't deserve to breathe the same air as Hulk Hogan and I. And then asked him if he wanted his ideas to live forever. Load up the spaceship with the rocket fuel. Something else he said. The Ultimate Warrior is totally out of control, is one he said, which the most sage thing he's ever said. He had a comic book series. Well, he legally changed his name to Warrior after he left the WWE, which many people point at as a sign of his, like buying the gimmick and, like, losing his mind. But you know what?
I think it was more that they stole his gimmick.
Fair play to him. Like, in that one instance, that was savvy. Like, if I change my name to...
Yeah.
Warrior, they can't stop me calling myself the Warrior. And he traded on that as much as possible. He had a comic book series, one of which has a picture of Santa Claus naked, clearly having been beaten unconscious, with the Ultimate Warrior putting on his clothes. And it's one of the most horrifically suggestive things in the world. He had a philosophy, Destrucity. That's the truce between destiny and reality.
Okay.
We talk about this all the time, Destrucity. And the thing is all the stories told about it talk about, like, you know, obviously the Warrior did buy into his gimmick somewhat. His ex-wife said that, you know, Jim Hellwig left one day and the Ultimate Warrior came home. And there's a Dark Side of the Ring, you know, that wonderful documentary series all about him.
Right.
But yeah. Shit, where was I going? I was going with somewhere with that. Oh, yes. Destrucity. Yeah, there's a great story from Jim Cornette where he met the Ultimate Warrior and he's talking about Destrucity. And then Jim Cornette just says, Destrucity, what the fuck is that? And Vince McMahon just goes, it's Destrucity, pal.
like it's the normalest thing in the world.
Yeah. What do you think? It's Destrucity, pal. But then again, considering what Vince McMahon thinks is normal behavior.
But that does seem like such a Vince McMahon response to that, to just be like, I don't know, dude, it is what it is.
It's
what
Destrucity. What's so great about Destrucity is I actually agree with the core of the philosophy. But Destrucity is a dumb word, and everything Ultimate Warrior says... sounds like it came from an imbecile, from a roided up meathead, because that's what it did. But Destrucity is the truce between destiny and reality, which is accepting where you are in life now and what you are now, while still, like, keeping sight of what you want to become and what you want to do. And it's finding the balance between those two things. And that's actually, like... I like that.
Yeah, there's something to that.
But it's wrapped up in the Ultimate Warrior's inanity. But I love it. I have been wandering around, like, the house, just going like, oh, Hogan, I will ask you as you asked me on the terrain of testament. Do you want your ideas to live forever? God, kids thought he was awesome. He went on TV, like, they aired it. You watch it and it is like the manifesto of a lunatic. But I think I'm going to start painting my face. I'm going to start painting a bird on my face.
That just makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, like instead of the I think it's a particular type of eagle, I think. It's something of some cultural significance. Whether it was significant to his culture or not, I don't know. But I'm going to get Busby done on mine, which is a yellow bird that advertised British Telecom in the 1980s.
I'm
going to get that painted on my head, on my face, and then I will have music that goes like that, and I'll run really fast. I won't get as far as the ring like he did to be able to shake it, but I will... I'll run top speed, and I'll shake whatever is there when I stop. And that's going to be my life from now on.
Well, my life from now on is going to be Pogquisition. It's ostensibly what we're here doing. We talk about video games and stuff.
We're going to move on from my sub-show, Dork Side of the Ring, and we're going to transition to regular type Pogquisition now. That'd be good, wouldn't it?
We got there within 11 minutes. That's, you know, not the worst we've ever done here on that.
It was a fascinating look at a very wrong individual.
I dare say philosophically enlightening.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed.
It's Districity, pal.
Well, maybe some of the video games we've played this week will be, you know, philosophically enlightening Districity. Who's played stuff this week?
I forgot to write mine down. I've done two. So
I mean, you played
I've played technically one.
I'll start then, because I got a few things. None of mine are going to be particularly long things to talk about for various reasons this week, but I'll jump in.
Mm-hmm.
I played a little bit of a game this morning, and I've not played enough of it to have, like, big picture thoughts about it, but I'm interested in it enough that I think it's worth talking and making you both aware of. It's an interesting game. It is called Content Warning.
Okay.
It released a couple of days ago. I believe it was free on April Fool's Day for 24 hours and is now paid. It's like £7. It's a really interesting little game. The premise is you are doing four-player online co-op in first person with three other people, either people you already know or jump in with random people online. And the gist of it, you know the kind of YouTubers that go to, like, haunted houses trying to, like, take, like, shaky phone video and pretend they've seen, like, haunted shit?
Yeah.
What if there was real haunted shit, and you had very limited, you know, battery and memory on your phone, and the four of you were running around getting chased by spooky monsters trying your best to get footage to post on YouTube and get famous?
I fucking love this. Like, conceptually, right? I love this. It actually reminds me a little bit, like, years and years ago, I'm a big fan of Max Headroom, and this has come up once or twice in the past. But I fantasized about the idea of how would one adapt Max Headroom into a video game, like, proper? And this is kind of it to a certain extent. Like, you have a camera, you're in the field, you need to get the story, but you have limited capacity, you know, so on and so forth. So I love this idea.
So the gist is you've got, like, limited amounts of footage you can capture. You are vulnerable, like, at least from what I've seen from playing a little bit of it today. You don't have any way to, like, fight back or anything. You are in danger. You can get killed by the various creatures. Some of them are, like, goofy scary, and some of them are genuinely scary, but you're running around as a group of people with, like, little emoji, light up, colorful faces. You're a bunch of, like, faceless YouTube faces trying to get footage of the things as you run away from them in terror, switching your phone to, like, selfie mode so you, like, you can be in the shot while trying to get the monster in the shot. You have limited oxygen, and you basically have to, like, get the best footage you can and get out safely. But the thing that really sells it is what happens afterward. When you successfully, as your group, you bail, either because you're running out of oxygen or, like, you don't want to risk any longer, you know, getting killed by anything, you all go back up to the surface to this little house together, and you get to watch the footage that all of you collectively captured. And, you know, it's rated on, like, how many creatures did you see, did you get good footage of it, and, like, mechanically, that's your scoring system for getting, like, between run currency you can use to buy stuff that will make future runs easier and more successful, or just be silly. But you get to sit and watch everyone's, like, hastily recorded, slightly crappy monster hunting footage in a little room together, and then you can download it as just, like, an MP4 file, so you can have your little shitty homemade, here's the four of us trying to, the video we just about made while being chased by monsters.
That's grand.
And it's, I need to put more time into it. I don't know, like, for example, I've only seen one environment to explore. I don't know if there's, like, more environments or anything. I don't know, like, what the scope is on terms of those between mission upgrades and how much they're going to sort of fundamentally change the experience, but there's things like you can get a boom arm for getting better audio. Also, it's a thing that you can poke at a monster that's running at you from a distance and whatnot. But the concept's really neat. It is just kind of everyone frantically fumbling, and you're probably going to end up getting like split up, and it's probably a good idea to split up and get your own footage, but you all come back together from scattering around, running on voice chat, being a little terrified of the things chasing after you, and you come back and you see a combined little snapshot of everyone's time.
That's really fun.
Yeah, I'm really interested in it. I saw earlier today, apparently, like, 6 million people downloaded it in the 24 hours it was free.
Fucking hell.
And I, like, for a game that's from a studio that's never released a game before, I think it's done really well for them because it's gotten their first game. There seems to be a really good ability to matchmake with people online. And that's a really good start for something like this, having people to play it with. But yeah, it's called Content Warning, and I need to put more time into it. I'm really interested by, like, the general concept, and I wish I'd had more time to play more of it before we talked today.
Cool.
Yeah. And that sounds really fun. That's a great idea.
Yep.
Like, it's one of them games where you just hear the concept, and look, like you did, Conrad, you just immediately, like, that's fucking great.
Yeah. It's been a while since an idea for a silly multiplayer thing has grabbed me as quickly as this did.
Yeah.
And the execution is really nice.
It's nice to see something that original rather than, like, so clearly iterative. Like, so many multiplayer, like, there's so much asymmetrical multiplayer now. And I love that as a concept, but there's so much. You know, we've got a Killer Clowns from Outer Space game coming, and I want to be excited, but following on from Texas Chainsaw and Evil Dead and Friday the 13th, all of them this same type of thing.
Yeah.
God, it's just a breath of fresh air to hear, you know, four-player, like, multiplayer, and it be something new. Even if it's, like, I'm not sure that's something I'd necessarily, like, be up for playing much myself.
Yeah, I have no interest in playing it. None.
But I love the concept, and I would watch someone play that.
I don't know how much of it I will end up sinking my time into, but I've enjoyed what I've played, and I've enjoyed it enough that I wish I'd been able to play more of it, which is rare for me with this kind of game. So, yeah, it's an interesting one. It's worth being aware of, at the very least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sounds grand.
Yeah. While I'm here, because I got the most stuff this week, I'll throw one other quick thing. That's not really a game, but a thing I want a space to talk about regardless anyway.
Yeah.
I have been fucking around with the MIG switch, which is, we talked about this a while back, it is a flash card that exists and functions on unmodded Switch hardware. And I want to talk about this because I think it is worth talking about as a thing that exists. So, right now, the creators of this Switch flash card have, I think, done a pretty fucking admirable job of making it very difficult to use it as anything other than a legitimate backup your own software onto one cartridge device.
Mm-hmm.
That is often the defense that people who make clearly designed to be piracy devices will lean on, is that, oh, no, we're expecting people to use it for their own backups of their own games. In this case, I think it's going to be a harder argument for Nintendo to disprove than in most situations. At present, the way that this thing works is, unlike a lot of, like, flash carts you see for consoles, where you plug it in, you boot it up, and it, like, boots to a menu where you can just load any fucking ROM from, like, a custom menu, this is emulating a lot of very specific things about your unique Switch cartridge of a game. It is not booting to some, like, special menu that they've managed to, like, trick the Switch into running. When you put this thing in, the Switch believes 100% this is the original cartridge of one specific game. And that does allow for things like being able to play online multiplayer games without risking getting banned in a way that you could not do with, say, a modded Switch or an emulator. And the way that it does this is because it requires a lot of files to run, some of which are uniquely identifying to your specific Switch cartridge. Now, at present, to even use this thing, you need a modded Switch available. There is no other way at present to take a legitimate Switch cartridge and make it and get the files you need to put on this flash cart to back up your games to have them on the flash cart. In the very near future, there is going to be, within weeks, a USB device that you just plug a Switch game into and it'll read the games off a Switch cartridge and let you drag and drop them to your PC.
Mm-hmm.
And I've talked about this before. At that point, there will legitimately be a degree of risk in buying secondhand Switch cartridges. Because, in theory, someone could buy a Switch game, dump the unique identifying files onto their flash cart, sell it back or return it to the store or whatever, or sell it for trading credit. And if the person with the game backed up on their flash cart and the person with the original cartridge played online at the same time, Nintendo could theoretically go, that's the same cartridge in two places at once, ban them. I don't think that's likely. I think that anyone that is using this in that kind of way would probably be sensible enough to know to play offline.
You'd
if
hope.
Someone out there might have the same cartridge and files as you. But it's inherently something that people should probably be aware of. Like, fundamentally, there will be a shift in the reliability of buying secondhand games as a result of this. In terms of function, it does function indistinguishably from running a game off of a legitimate cartridge. And I can see use cases for this where I'm going to be traveling and I don't want to bring a bunch of Switch carts with me while I'm traveling because they're little things, they're easy to lose. I'd rather just have the games I want to play while I'm traveling on a single cartridge that's in the Switch. And for that, this is pretty perfect. There are some slight differences in loading times. Loading times are ever so slightly longer on this because it's going via a micro SD card to the Switch cartridge to the Switch rather than, like, there's one extra step of transferring data
right.
that's having to happen. It's not noticeable enough that, like, it is detrimental to the experience, but if you put them side by side, that difference is there. Because this thing doesn't have, like, a menu you boot into to select games, the other sort of drawback to it is the way that you functionally switch between games. Let's say you had 5 games loaded onto this thing that you'd legitimately backed up. In order to switch which game the Switch thinks this flash cart is, you would have to eject the Switch cartridge and then within about a second and a half, plug it back in, and it will appear to be a different game. There is a short window of time in which you eject it and reinsert it, and it cycles to the next game. If you take the cartridge out entirely and then, like, 20 minutes later put it back in, it will still be the game it was on before. It's eject it and put it back in. But obviously, that means that if you've got a big collection of Switch games and you're putting, like, 100 physical games you have on
yeah, there, that is not practical.
And you want to get to a particular one, it's not particularly practical. The practical way you would be using this in a situation like that would be back up your 100 games to your PC, put the ones that you currently want to be cycling between playing onto the flash cart, and cycling between that more limited number. It is not feasible reasonably to put your entire physical collection onto one cartridge and get to a specific game you want to boot up.
Which is also actually really points to them not wanting this used as a piracy device in a big way. Like, because that's avoidable.
Yeah, there are ways they could have had, like, a Switch on the top of this where you just, like, click a little button on the top of the cartridge or something. Like, there's ways you could have worked mm-hmm. around it. And again, it does feel like there is legitimate intent to minimize the ease of which someone can use this as a piracy device. Now, that all being said, I've fucked around with this thing a bit out of curiosity. It is not a piracy-proof device. Piracy via this device, I'm going to be careful with how much I say here, requires other people on the internet who are uploading stolen games to change their behavior about how they upload stolen games. For people who don't mind playing offline, it seems like not all of the unique files are needed that the people who make this device claim are needed. There's really only one file that people uploading pirated copies of games would need to start uploading. And it's very specific. It would need to match, like, the specific cartridge revision, the specific region that the game was uploaded from. It's a very specific file. But if people started uploading those, this does enable piracy on unmodded hardware. And that is starting to happen. There are groups that are starting to go, here is big dumps of these very small files that are the one file you need to get a ROM running on an unmodded hardware if you don't mind playing offline. It's certainly not a device that is immune to mm-hmm. being used as a piracy tool. But I also think that it's worth noting that we're in a world where it's so fucking easy to mod a launch day Switch. There is so much easy availability of emulators that run on relatively low-end hardware for Switch titles. I don't think anyone's going to buy this to be a piracy tool. Anyone that cares enough is probably just going to mod a day one Switch because it's easier, because they can just drop a ROM on and have it appear on their home screen and not have to cycle through things with a physical cartridge. I think that, like, I think legitimately the market that exists for this is, do you own physical Switch games you don't want to take multiple of when traveling and kind of want like four or five of them at a time on hand? And for that, it does the trick.
I mean, you could also have a very large backup library and, you know, keep three or four of them around at any time that you're cycling through. Like, there's still some practicality to it, but
That's what I'm saying. Like, it's if you update the SD card with the legitimate backups of your own cartridges that you are likely to be cycling between at the moment, and update that semi-regularly as you want to be playing other games from your backlog, this is a way to not risk losing your cartridges while traveling, or whatever other preservation purpose you have in mind. It is a device that I think a lot of people probably expected to be a lot more of a jump right the fuck into piracy tool than it ultimately is, while acknowledging there does seem to be movement online of people moving to make using it a piracy tool easier. It's a real interesting curiosity. I'm fascinated with it, even if it is for a very niche use case. So yeah, that is the MIG Switch. What about you, Steph? What you been playing this week?
I've been playing two games. The main one is playing a lot more of Rise of Ronin. I'm playing it now. I've got it on the portal thing. I'm on a horrible fucking hang glider mission. I've been playing the heck out of it, like, constantly. I am at a point where the open world busy work stuff has gotten very repetitive. Like, I've picked up and pet over 50 cats now, and I'm like, it gets a lot, you know. And when you boil it down, it is a lot of bandit camps and you know, like, nebulous collectibles. Like, just the usual stuff.
Yeah.
And, like, with the latter-day Ubisoft games, like, I was warming to the Assassin's Creed games, and I quite liked Origins, you know, up until, you know, we found out they were the Catholic Church of video games over at Ubisoft. And I like the way Sony games seem to handle it. I certainly liked it in Horizon. And another recent one of theirs. But the combat system, my God, it really is, like, good. It's really good. The parrying is not quite as welcoming as Lies of P, where I really got with it. But it's definitely on the more accessible end of the Sekiro style of gameplay. Mm. One of the ways in which it eases up the Sekiro stuff is versatility. You have many different weapons to choose from. You know, it's got Neo's loot system. Many different weapons, with each one has, starting with at least three different combat styles that change how you wield an attack with the weapon and what it's effective at. And then there's a rock, paper, scissors thing going on with enemies to match styles. So every weapon, and there's like at least a dozen of them, each one with three starter weapon styles, and then there's more you can unlock. It's a lot. I went with a polearm and have also switched to adding in a bayonet, because you can equip two. And keeping track of what is essentially six move sets is a lot. And I have taken to just trying not to remember exactly how each one behaves, because you've got to kind of focus on the rock, paper, scissors element of making sure your fighting style is superior to their fighting style, because when you're doing all the parrying, if they're stronger than you, then the window you get after a successful parry is barely anything. So you want to have a stronger weapon. But that versatility eases up a lot of Sekiro stuff, because I suck at the parries. But one good thing they do is, when it comes to parrying them, the last attack is the only one that matters. So if you miss a few of their like first shots in a combo, if you can get back into the rhythm, you can deflect that last one and attack them. But it cuts both ways, because you can deflect all of them successfully, but if you fuck up that last one, you don't get anything. So it is very much a double-edged sword. But I think I like it overall. It really fast combat. The deflection stuff is weird, because the tells are almost all visual for regular combos. And they can be crafty fuckers. Like, some of the attacks, the timing is like, they're genuinely feinting you. And when I first played it, I was like, this is fucking overwhelming. You do start to get an innate sense of it. And I'm still not great, like I say, like, I miss, like, the parrying at least, like, half the time. But you also have access to sub-weapons, like rifles or arrows, or you get a fucking flamethrower, which at least for a portion of the game is so fucking powerful. And with the right build, you really can break the game. Like, I have got together a character that is just really fucking good, and when I'm up against an enemy whose, like, attack patterns I just feel a bit overwhelmed by, I've got all sorts of other things to fall back on. And, of course, there's co-op, which, unlike in some Souls-likes, co-op just turns bosses into a fucking joke. I've gotten online a lot more now that I've played a lot more story missions, and that's another issue with the way they've designed the online, you know?
Yeah.
The fact you can only play online with specific story missions that you have played through, it really limits you at first, and it can be a hassle. But love the visuals. Like, I really like the costumes, the armor pieces, and like how you... The fashion Souls thing is very strong with this. I love all the weapon designs, and the stealth's really quite good as well. Like I said last week, it reminds me of Singularity, but with Sekiro, Neo, those kind of faster-paced Souls-likes, where it's like a best of. Like, it's got really good stealth and parrying stuff, like in Sekiro. It's got a bunch of Souls-like elements. It's got a lot of Neo inspiration, which it obviously would, you know, being with Team Ninja and that. I'm really impressed with it. I really like this game, and to give it its flowers on its own merits rather than, like, comparing it in a snippy fashion to something else, it is on its own merit so fucking user-friendly. For a game that can be, until you break it, it's quite a tricky game. Quite a bit to get your head around, a lot of systems, and the parrying is, you know, it can be important, even if you can work around it. But getting around the world is a fucking joy. The grappling hook is so responsive and fast. The horse, when I found out that you could be on your hang glider, then press the horse whistle button, and that means you drop from the hang glider and do a little, like, roll in the air and land on the horse's back in just one swift motion. Like, that impresses me. And I'm always impressed by like, quality of life in a game. Cutting out the shit that doesn't need to be there. Rise of Ronin doesn't excel in all of that. There's too much of the busy work stuff. But when it comes to getting around the world, when it comes to getting into the action, it's such a quick and responsive game. And that's my kind of thing. And it was making those latter-day Assassin's Creed games work so well for me, is it's, if I can loot from horseback, you've done a good thing. One of my benchmarks for quality of life is if I can loot a body without getting off a horse, that's great, because that's fucking direct. I don't get anything from getting off a horse. And that's what this game is. It's just throw loot at them and get them to the action quick. And I like that. It does throw a lot of loot at you, though. Like, that is laborious. You have to really manage. And it can be cool. Like, you know, I've been able to, like, that thing where you can take passive bonuses from weapons and put them on another. I wish it were a bit more versatile like it is in Dynasty Warriors, say, because that's got a similar sort of weapon slot system where you can swap slots out for stuff, rather than in this, you can only take one trait from a weapon and then that's destroyed, and you can only fill an empty slot. So it's hard to really sort of build a piece of gear that you really, really love. But I've got ridiculously overpowered shoes that give me a really big XP bonus. So, yeah, I really like that as well. I really like a lot of the loot stuff, like the loot traits. But I don't so much like that there's so much to go through. And yeah, that's what I think of Rise of Ronin. I'm very impressed, very pleased with it. Very glad I gave it a go. I'm very glad you put it on my radar, Laura.
I'm glad you're digging
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
What about you, Conrad? What you been playing
this week? I have been playing a deeply charming Metroidvania called Islets. Islets, the plural of small islands.
Smaller, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
This came out like a year and a half ago. Heard nothing about it. It did happen to pop up free on Epic this past week, which is why I wound up playing, but I heard someone else recommend it to me in the not too distant past. This is fascinating to me because of what it does. As the name implies, it goes across a series of small islands, and it is a Metroidvania, and these islands are their own maps. But about the midpoint or two-thirds of the way through exploring that map, maybe 80%, you'll find a point that will connect it to the other maps you've visited and sort of link them together so you can pass between them. And so you're building a larger map out of connecting the smaller maps back together. It's really cool. Like, it's not complicated necessarily. It's not dynamic in any way. It's always going to fit together the same way, but it's a great idea.
It looks visually charming.
It is very visually charming. Cool. It is charming in the writing as well. You are one of hundreds of warriors who has traveled to these islands to try and bring them back together. They're populated by beasts. There's a legend of three great beasts. It follows a fairly predictable path of plot, but there's a bunch of little secondary characters that have their little stories that are all very cute, and you have a rival who is one of the most effective one of these rival characters, because everything that comes from him makes me want to smack the taste out of his mouth. Like, he is so fucking insufferable, and yet charming, because it's all too kind of quaint and lighthearted. Even, like, bad guy characters that you will encounter who are doing truly monstrous things if you stop for a moment to consider their actions. And it's just like, oh, that guy. Oh, he's incorrigible.
Sort of like how England treated Hitler for a long time.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Like that.
Until he tried to take, like, their shit.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Although, the funny thing in this circumstance is you're watching him do something to someone else that he tried to do to you. And you're like, ah, there he goes again. From a gameplay perspective, it's also very light and swift. Like, it's nimble as a Metroidvania. Yeah. You have a sword attack, which is your basic attack, and then you also have arrows that you can fire. The arrows are generally lower damage than your sword attack, but of course you do get range. They also will aim at the direction of the nearest enemy quite a bit, so you don't need a lot of accuracy. There isn't fucking around with another thumbstick to target. That all works pretty well. I don't rely on the arrows much, except when I get into a, like, oh shit, I'm gonna die situation. I better just eliminate some enemies at range. But it has that limited ammo of you can use a certain number of arrows until you run out, and then if you want more arrows, you have to attack enemies. So it does balance it. You can't rely solely on archery. it is a Metroidvania, so there's going to be a lot of backtracking in it. And one of the things I think this game does exceptionally well is in the additional abilities that you collect through the course of the game, all having really profound effects on traversal. You know, the first ability you get is a double jump, and of course that's going to be pretty useful. But one you get reasonably quickly after that is the ability to just straight up climb flat walls. And that gives you so much more flexibility in how you navigate environments that you've already been in to accomplish them so much faster and get from one end of the map to another. Because while there are a fair number of fast travel portals that you can use to move around the map, you're still going to have to do a bit of running around. Another nice thing that this game does, you can buy an ability to teleport from save spaces also. It like triples the number of points you can travel from on the map. Same number you can travel to. You can only travel to the portals, but you can from the save spaces. Huge time saver. It's just a very thoughtful, fun, fast-paced Metroidvania game that I really loved. There is another little portion to it that is significant. I should probably bring up. Maybe a quarter of this game is a bullet hell. To travel between the islands, you're going to be in a little airship. And to unlock new islands, you're going to have some boss encounters in that airship. These are mostly kind of, I don't want to say tedious, but they're not particularly inspiring bullet hell shoot 'em up things. Until you get to like the last one of them, because you've finally gotten a dodge for your airship. And then it's really dynamic and fun and cool, and you really only get to do this twice. And that's kind of a bummer. I like the Guardian Legend, which has a similar sort of overworld exploration, top-down exploration of a map area, and then traveling between map areas with a shoot-em-up stage. And I like that. I don't think the execution here is great, but it's, like, not bad enough to complain about. It's just sort of meh. But the platforming action stuff is all quite fun. Really enjoyed it. Cool monster designs. Generally, the art's good. The music's good. I would check this out. And I guess this guy puts out a Metroidvania every 2 years, because he put one out a couple of years ago called Sheepo that I've never heard of, but I'm going to check out next. And he's got one coming out later this year called Crypt Custodian that looks kind of cool. So, yeah. Kyle Thompson.
And that's Islets, right?
Islets. Yes. Yeah. I think you would like it, Steph.
I shall take a peek.
Yeah.
I'm always interested in checking out a new Metroidvania.
Yeah. I've got a couple of other things I've played this week that I can talk about that aren't going to take very long at all to do. I finally finished Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. There sure is a fucking lot of video game in that video game.
There is so much video game.
There is a point in that video game where you think you have a scope of how big the video game is, and then they're like, hey, you know all those places you 100%ed? Yeah, there's like three or four new things in every one of them. Go, keep going, there's more game.
Yeah, and it's always a jumping, like, it's always a splitting point at that point in a game when they offer you a whole bunch more, when it's, oh, for fuck's sake.
It's a bit of a cruel trick, right? Because you felt like you were done. Like, I've done it, I've completed the journey, and now they pull the rug out from under you if you're one of those completionist type people.
Yeah. But that very much is a sort of fork in the road, depending on what the game's done up to that point. Now, Final Fantasy VII Rebirth is one of those very rare games where the characters were so well written, and the party dynamic was so fucking good that I wanted to keep not just like enjoying the game, which was, you know, so much of that game is excellent, but I wanted to spend more time in that world that had so much personality and with that group who were so well written as this sort of growing group of friends who just sort of come to trust each other more as they go through some weird fucking shit. So with Final Fantasy VII, compared to some games that do it where I'm like, oh, fucking hell. That was one of the very rare times where I was like, oh, good. And that's so rare. And you've got to be such a good fucking game. Because a lot of games think the more we put in, the better the game. And that's such a not the right attitude, because there's so much to be said. And people have said it, you know, ever since fucking Portal. I mean, before Portal, but that was a game that sort of really sort of, I think, changed the conversation. But that conversation has been circular since then. You know, sometimes a game can outstay its welcome. Many games outstay their welcome. Sorry, I really did just derail that. I'm so sorry.
That's all right. But yes, point being, I agree with you in terms of how I feel about the amount of content in that game, but I don't blame anyone who doesn't. I get how the way they deliver that last little burst of extra stuff to do could be off-putting. And I've been thinking specifically about comparisons to the other game I've played this year that was a big sprawling RPG that has a whole bunch of weird little side content and at some point completely expands in scope beyond what you thought it was offering you, like A Dragon Infinite Wealth. And I think the thing that Infinite Wealth did really well, that I would maybe criticize Rebirth for, is even at the points where Like A Dragon Infinite Wealth expands its scope beyond what you thought you were getting, maybe even similarly late into the game, Infinite Wealth does a good job of making its biggest side content relatively early in the experience and tapering off the density of those kind of side diversions as you get further into the game. It does perhaps a better job of letting you feel how far you are into the game because there is a natural tapering of shifting the balance a little toward the plot. I think it is fair to say that Rebirth feels like it's trying to deliberately got you with more content. And I don't blame anyone who has that feeling of, like, I'm ready to see that closure and then feels a little sort of caught off guard by it.
Well, I mean, that is something I criticised in the early goings as well. And it is a consistent problem. As much as I love the game, there is a pacing issue. And if you G them up for the big confrontation, yeah, like you say, very understandable if people are like, well, fucking hell, you just hyped me up for something.
And very specifically, I think the problem is if you feel like you've been a completionist all the way and you're like, my reward for having completionism everywhere as I'm going is that I can now just go with the plot. If you're someone that wants to be that completionist, suddenly it's like, oh, well, it's only three or four more things every hour, I guess I should go do them, when you'd sort of gotten yourself into a mindset ready. That's maybe my biggest complaint with the game, and it's a very small thing. It's not enough for me to not enjoy the game. I think, like, big picture, having now finished it, I am honestly surprised that it took getting as far into the game as it did for some of those differences from Final Fantasy VII's original version to happen. I was cautiously skeptical after part one of what the fuck they were going to do with this. And I've come away from part two very differently. I've come away from part two actively optimistic and excited to see what they're going to change. I think my big feeling walking away from, like, in no spoiler terms, maybe the last 3 or 4 hours of the game, I think they did a very good job of being respectful of what came before, not being afraid to do new things, and finding a way to walk the line between the thing that you expected and the new thing can both kind of coexist, and we're going to narratively acknowledge both of them in an interesting way. I think that's a really smart choice, and I'm actively very intrigued by what they're doing. There is still a degree of, will they stick the landing? You know, I have a little bit of caution that I keep there, but generally speaking, I'm feeling a lot less like, oh god, are they going to Kingdom Hearts all over this? And a lot more, you found a pretty good way to not shit over what you did before, but to really lean into, we want to be able to do other things with this story. Other than that, it's the same comments I've had through most of the game. Some of the things going on in it are baffling in ways that I'm genuinely fascinated by. I still don't understand some of the choices they're making, but I'm excited about that now, and that's great. Yes. I think that a lot of the characterization makes really smart choices in how it adapts the original versions of the characters. I think Yuffie is maybe the best example of taking a character and, like, introducing her earlier on with Integrade, making her more immediately part of the core plot, and giving her Barrett to be the, like, the straight man foil to her style of behavior.
Yeah.
I think does a lot to, like, really make her character fun.
Mm-hmm.
Any irritation, the joke is on Barrett, not on you, the player.
Yes.
And I think that really benefits her.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, like, people found her annoying because her job was to annoy them. Now her job's to annoy Barrett, and it's fun watching Barrett be annoyed.
I really like the stuff they did with Kate Sith or Kate She.
I always read it as Kate Sith as a kid. Then people used to go, actually, it's Kate She. And then you play Rebirth, and they're all saying Kate Sith.
My understanding is they're all saying Kate Sith in Rebirth, because if they started saying Kate She, everyone would go, what the fuck is this bullshit? Yeah. That's not the name. Everyone would grumble. But yeah, I believe it's Kate She, which is like an actual thing. But I'm going to use Kate Sith here for simplicity.
So they had the opportunity to correct it.
Yeah, and they didn't. So, you know, you said something at some point, Steph, when talking about this game that has stuck in my head, and I think you really hit the nail on the head. Kate Sith is so likably handled in this that I second-guessed things I knew.
Yes, they get you, don't they?
Yeah, and that's the thing. Enough little things in Rebirth are not quite how they used to be that, paired with how completely well-handled the character is, I was willing to believe that things would be different.
Yes. I was like, oh, because they start talking about stuff that you're not supposed to find out until later. And I was like, oh, that, so that must mean they've changed all that. Like, they've really softened it up to make you like him more. And I really like him. And, like, you can tell, especially if you've played the original, like, you know that he genuinely likes the party and everything. And you see that. And they manage to pull the rug again because you're lulled into it. And it's such a great double bluff. And that's one of the several reasons I say this game is operating like on a different level to most games.
And my last very, very quick thought to throw in, the comparison I keep thinking about. I know that Final Fantasy XV is the road trip one. It's your boy band, your pretty boys in a car going on a road trip across the country.
Yeah.
Rebirth feels like so much more of a road trip story than 15 ever did.
Yeah. I'll tell you what I think the difference is. You get a road trip with 15. And 7, I totally agree, has a even more of a road trip vibe, but the difference is scale. And I think it's the difference between a road trip and what you call like a globe-trotting adventure. That's how I felt, like I was trotting the globe.
I kind of wanted to put it a different way, which is, while 15 feels like a road trip, it feels like a very utilitarian road trip. Mm. Whereas Rebirth feels like a road trip where you're allowed to go, we're passing a road sign for the world's biggest ball of yarn, can we take the next turning?
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah.
It feels like the road trip where you're allowed to go, forget the schedule, there's a weird fucking thing over there. This is not just the party of people you are going to save the world with, this is your group of friends you're going on stupid, silly little ADHD diversions with.
Yeah.
That does a lot to really build these characters out.
I think what helps as well is we see all that from the beginning. We see the friendships form, and that makes it more of a journey. Whereas even though it is a geographic, like you say, a utilitarian journey in 15, they already know each other, like the four friends, and that relationship doesn't change for the game. And also half of what's going on in the game is the game having a conversation with itself that we've walked in halfway in on. Like with 7, you more or less know what's going on, question mark? Like what you're seeing on screen is baffling, but the actual plot, you know what's going on. You see it from the beginning, you see the friendships build and like Barrett soften up and Cloud open up and all of this. And yeah, I think that contributes atmospherically to the road trip.
Mm.
And I think that's the difference. I think in practicality, 15 is a traditional road trip. And you're right. Like in every other way, 7 is the better road trip. That's a really good point you made. I like that.
Oh, thank you. I've got one other game I'll very quickly get out of the way while I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
I talked about the demo for this a little while back, but there was a game that had a demo called Pepper Grinder.
Mm-hmm.
The full game itself is out now. For anyone who didn't hear last time I talked about it, it is a pixel art, side-scrolling, sort of challenging platformer, but in the same way as, like, Celeste, you've got tools like the ability to slow down the game's speed. There's very generous checkpointing to sort of help you through the very, like, deliberately quite challenging platforming. But the gimmick with it is that you have a drill, and you've got this sort of side-on perspective. Once you start drilling into a material, you don't stop moving, you can kind of loop around, but you're ultimately trying to dash between drillable materials and do combat. The full game is out now, and I very much enjoy it, but I think that there is a caveat to be given, and for me this is a positive, or at least not a negative, but I know it's going to be a negative for some people. It is quite a short game.
Mm.
I finished the game in maybe like 4 to 5 hours, I would guess. I walked away from it wanting more. Nothing in it was bad. To the contrary, it was fantastic start to finish, and I will undoubtedly hop back into it to go look for the collectible coins and things I missed in some of the levels and stuff like that. But I do feel like there is a degree of I wish there was more of this game that maybe steps a little over the line from I've been left wanting more to it feels like there are missed opportunities. I think the thing that makes me feel that way is if this game only used the drilling mechanic, I would probably be pretty understanding of its length. I would go, cool, you feel like you did everything you could with that mechanic. Don't outstay your welcome. Great. There is at least one other mechanic introduced midway through that's a different thing that's not the drill that can interact with the drill. The example I will give here is you've got a little grapple hook, and sometimes you dash out of the material you're drilling through, grapple onto this hook, and maybe you'll do a sort of semicircle swing at like the furthest length of your grapple, and you'll swing around to something else you can drill through. That was really cool. And that set my expectation to be, okay, we're introducing additional new mechanics that will interact with the drilling. The drilling is the core mechanic, but we are introducing supplemental mechanics to, like, augment what the drilling can be, and that's where the sort of scope of this is going to come from. And then they just didn't introduce more mechanics.
No.
It set my expectations that I would there would be, like, one or two or three more of these things introduced that the drill would be alongside, and then that's not it at all. And it gave me a weird place of expectation. I think it was helped that someone told me the game was quite short before I had finished it, and that helped me not feel particularly negative when the ending came. But I think if you don't know that going in, you're going to hit that ending and go, wait, the ending's now. It doesn't, like, build to make you realize the ending's coming.
You know, I'm glad you've said something, because I am at the end of World 1 now. And I'm expecting, you know, well, I mean, 8 worlds would be, for the number of levels in these, would be a good length.
Off the top of my head, I don't know this for a fact, I think it's 5.
Yeah, that's what I'm, yep. That sounds right.
Yeah, you see why that's... It's not so short that I feel cheated, but it's short enough that, like,
you wish
my expectation...
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just, like, a little bit more and a little better signposting of this is the last one, I think would have helped.
Yeah, yeah.
I think everything I've played in it has been fantastic. I've had a great time with it, and I certainly don't begrudge a very well-made game that I can complete and put down after 4 or 5 hours and go, I played a complete experience. I really appreciate that. But I think you need to have your expectations correct, and that the game doesn't necessarily help you have your expectations in the right place.
I think it's very good, though. Like, what I have played in this first world, it's clever. It introduces enough mechanics just in those first levels that are very curious and have a lot of potential, and it's quick without feeling unreasonably fast, and then knowing that I could slow it down if I were struggling with it more, which I think I'm fine, but that's a really good approach to a game like this with this kind of difficulty.
Yeah, I'm not ashamed to say I used it for a couple of bosses toward the end. I did a little bit of speed slowdown. But yeah, everything you've said, consistent through the whole experience. It is a really well-made game that's biggest problem is not setting its own expectation of length well for the player. Mm-hmm. But go in knowing that, and if you're someone that's like, yeah, that's not a problem for me, the 4 or 5 hours you spend with it are going to be, they're going to be great.
Yeah, yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. Is that everything we've played, or did it, Steph, did you have one more?
I had one more. I'm not super far in, I mean, I've played it before, but I'm replaying Final Fantasy X.
Mm.
My tag team partner and dear friend Priscilla Queen of the Ring has been replaying a bunch of Final Fantasies. She was doing Final Fantasy IX recently and beat that this week, so moved on to 10. And I was talking about it, I was like, because it's the only game I've ever played, thinking I hated it, and then once I finished, realized I loved it. Weird game, like such an adjustment from like the others. And you know, 9 being my favorite, 10 was a, I reacted to it a bit the way people reacted to 8 after they got hooked on 7.
Mm.
You know, first one with the voicing and changes to the battle system to this more of a turn-based deal. There's a lot different in it, but my God, like, the music is great. And it is a good game. Like, the combat is fun, and the story is weird and strange and interesting, but the characters are good. And yeah, that intro, it still slaps with that music, that now, the whole intro with the Blitzball, and it's still so fucking cool. So that's been nice and nostalgic. Final Fantasy,
yeah. Should we quickly get a couple of bits of gaming news out of the way and then just bugger off for that?
Yeah, you know, I reckon we can get away with that, you know? I reckon they'd let us. Yeah.
I think there's a couple of bits that are worth chatting about this week. Let's get this one out of the way first. Do you remember a while ago there was that patent doing the rounds of the idea was to verify someone's age to play an age-restricted video game, you'd use your phone to, like, scan your face and collect face biometrics to estimate your age.
Terrifying.
And, like, use AI to go, yeah, you seem old enough to play this. Yeah,
that's... it's like the dude at the convenience store trying to figure out whether you look old enough that you're going to have to ask for ID.
Yeah.
Right?
That's fantastic. Right?
So, yeah, the application to use that tech was submitted by the ESRB in July of last year. And the update is, the Federal Trade Commission has blocked plans to do this. The FTC says, no, you're fucking not scanning faces to try and work out ages.
Oh, my God. I mean, that's really, I mean, because nothing untoward would have happened with all of those facial scans. Nothing.
Yeah. Yeah.
You mean like potentially scanning the faces of a bunch of kids?
Yeah.
Yeah. Not to mention, you know, everyone else's, like, data that's getting saved. You know what? I think corporations have proven themselves responsible enough with our personal data and our identities, even, that I don't understand why anyone would have a problem with this.
The ESRB has responded to this by being like, no, FTC, you just don't understand. Your problem's with it. Don't worry. Let me read from the ESRB's quote. First and foremost, this application is not to authorize the use of this technology with children, full stop. Nor does this software take installed selfies of users to attempt to confirm the identity of users. This application makes no mention of using age estimation to prevent children from purchasing or downloading restrictively rated video games, nor do we intend to recommend its use in that way. It's facial recognition age estimation software, ESRB. What? They argue, it's not meant to be scanning children's faces, it's meant to be scanning adults' faces who are old enough to access the software. Children aren't old enough to access the software, so their faces shouldn't be being scanned with it.
I have a question. Excuse me, real quick. One question. So if it is scanning to confirm that these people are adults,
right,
and some
right.
people fail the scan, who are right. those people?
Right! You see, this is the fundamental problem.
Can you imagine if the world operated like this? Like, yeah. If anyone was suspected of a crime, they'd be thrown immediately in jail because, well, I mean, if they were innocent, they wouldn't have committed a crime. So, of course, they're criminals. They're in jail.
Like, you know what just... it is? It's the fucking click this tick box if you're over 18 on a porn website. It's The app that scans your face isn't for use by under-18s, so no under-18s are going to use the app to see if they can get away with their face appearing to be 18.
I mean, for God's sake, if it's an age gate, it's literally supposed to stop the kids that are trying it. Like, its very existence implies the existence of the people they say don't exist.
Yeah.
If the kids aren't accessing it, why do you have an age gate? You fucking cretins! You fucking cretins! I'm like, oh, God. I'm done reacting to it.
So we've got one other story I think that's worth chatting about this week, which is we got an Embracer update.
Ooh.
We got an Embracer update. And here's the update.
Vampire the Embrace.
You know how they've been selling off every fucking studio they have because they didn't get $2 billion from the Saudis, and suddenly they're like, oh, fuck, and throwing studios away as fast as they can. Apparently they're done with that for now. They've thrown away enough studios, they've sold enough studios off and ruined enough studios' potential futures. You know, they're alright for the minute. They're sorted themselves out. They've sorted out their money issues.
Good.
Now, there is another quote that goes along with this. I don't think anyone needed this quote. I don't see why Embracer CEO Lars Wingsfor felt it was necessary to issue this quote, but I will give it to you now. He says, it's way too early for Embracer to start talking about acquiring new studios.
Truer words.
Right. I'll tell you what, right? One of the biggest struggles I have with weight loss, right, is I'll lose some weight and then I'll think, I've lost a bit of weight. You know what? I can start eating, like, shit again. And you know what that does? It puts me in the same position I was, like, just in. And I feel like, that's, like, there needs to be an equivalent of a diet for corporations to stop them consuming.
Yeah, but they did the diet, and they're down to their target weight now.
That's it, so just start stuffing your face again. So, mate, embrace it. I've been there so many times. It's a cycle. Break it.
It's such a needless comment, but I am regardless glad they made it.
Oh,
I'm
no,
glad
brilliant.
To hear that Embracer is aware this is not a good time to start buying studios up again.
It's like the closest to self-awareness they've ever gotten. but presented in the least self-aware way.
Boy, imagine right. being the working for the company that Embracer buys right now.
Yeah.
Like, could you? Oh, boy.
I tell you what, it's good that they realize, like, the position they're in now. But they're still thinking ahead as to what they might accomplish.
Yeah, they're forward.
It's distrucity, pal. Embracer practices distrucity.
So, yeah, that's that. The only other thing I'll quickly throw in while we're here, we got a release date now for Nightmare Kart, which is legally distinct. It's definitely not based on any other horror-based Souls-esque property.
No.
Nightmare Kart.
I mean, that's the kart racer based on nightmare creatures, right? Oh, fuck.
Yeah,
no, don't. Let's not make that joke or they might actually get onto her.
Yeah, Nightmare Kart. It's got a release date. It's coming out on May 31st and it's going to be free and it's going to be on itch.io and Steam. That's cool. Also, I asked about this. There is accessibility settings in it. The ones that are currently in there include being able to turn off screen shake, change the camera distance, turn acceleration from a button hold to a toggle, and change first-person sensitivity. So that's fucking cool.
That's excellent.
Go support Nightmare Kart now that it has legally distinct as a bullet point feature in its list of in-game features.
Lilith's just a wonderful person in general. Very entertaining in person and brilliant. Like, when it comes to these, like, the games she's putting out, brilliant. Like, Bloodborne, the PSX Bloodborne. Like, we raved about it when it came out a couple of years ago. And everything I've looked at from Bloodborne Kart, Nightmare Kart,
Nightmare
Legally
Creatures. Distinct.
like, I've been following the development of that, and it looks great.
It's honestly really fucking impressive how quick the turnaround was into completely original, nothing legally in trouble happening. Like, the turnaround on this game, super impressive. Go support Nightmare Cart when it comes out. End of next month.
Yeah.
Yeah, and end of next month, that's like a little under 2 months away. Hell yeah. So yeah, that's it. We done it.
We've done it. Laura, what else you done? I'm sure people would like to know, because like, this is over now and they're terrified to be alone with their thoughts.
Well, people can find the stuff what I've done at Laura K Buzz in all the places where stuff happens to be. Stuff that you can check out now. I did a thing for BAFTA about special effect winning the BAFTA Games Special Award for 2024. You can go check that out on the BAFTA website if you look up the spotlight feature about special effect. I wrote a thing for BAFTA about basically summarizing like 15 plus years of special effects history as a charity, talking to a bunch of people who their work as a charity has helped in terms of making custom accessibility controllers. Really proud of that piece, really appreciate BAFTA asking me to say lovely words about a charity whose work I think is great. Things I've got coming up, I will be taking part in the Able Gamers charity gala happening this upcoming weekend. If you check out at Able Gamers on Twitter, you can find information about that. It'll be a lovely evening raising money for a charity that does great work for video game accessibility. And I've got a 35-minute video chat going up this week with a lovely accessibility creator called Arevia, talking about the PlayStation Access controller now that it's been out for several months, and opinions on it, you know, the difference in opinions based on, like, day one or having had a week or so with the device versus now that, you know, it's been out there for a few months and there's been more time to work out where it fits into gaming landscapes. How's the PS Access controller going? That'll be up this week. I'm super happy with that chat. I can't wait to share it. What about you, Conrad? Where are you on the internet?
I am at Conrad Zimmerman on Instagram and Blue Sky. You can hang out with me on Twitch at twitch.tv/thatconradzimmerman. You could buy anti-capitalist propaganda and Jimquisition merch at mercenarycreative.com. And everything I do online gets supported through Patreon at patreon.com/fistshark. And you know who else has a Patreon? Stephanie Sterling.
Fucking PlayStation Portable, fucking disconnected in the middle of a timed challenge. It's the worst machine ever. Patreon.com/Jimquisition. My return to wrestling. I'll be back in, I should be starting May, like next month. That's certainly when I'll be back in Leeds with True Grit. I'll be back May, June, sort of for their shows. I'll be in Blackpool at some point this year. I've got more stuff, some more content coming to Vampire Survivors. I'm working on a few little bits. Nothing super big, but some fun stuff. And the other game I can't talk about yet, but I think should be coming out this year. Fun stuff on the horizon. That's it. Thank you all for listening. We will see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.